That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Welcome to The New Next, a podcast that addresses current events and how they will impact the future.
Xi and head of China and Bashar al-Assad, head of Syria, recently announced a new strategic partnership. And why this is a big deal, you see a lot of adversaries of the United States, from Russia to China to Iran to Syria, really trying to economically and strategically band together to resist the Western defense industrial complex and all the history that goes along with that. So obviously I'm a huge fan of the United States and support our Western democracies, but we also have to acknowledge the fact that we've made quite a lot of strategically poor decisions, many times thinking that if we remove personalities out of certain areas without respect and understanding for the cultural backbone that put them in power in the first place, that everything would work out okay. That has not been the case as of late, and we've really seen this, I'd say, single polar world really developed into a multipolar world where the U.S. is more standing on itself alone, I would say, in many aspects. You know, a good comparison in history for this was when President George Bush in the early 2000s went to the U.N., to hold a vote to try to invade Iraq. And when that didn't work out, they just decided to do it anyways and build a separate coalition, a separate vote around that. And then we had the Iraq war, which there's a lot of debate on whether or not that was necessary. So this is from French news published in Barron's, and it talks about the strategic partnership that they're forming, both Syria and China. Let's see. But with that, you also have Iran, Venezuela, and Syria inking a landmark oil refinery deal. So a barrel per day refinery in Syria's home. You see here, it's three of US's typical, I guess, adversaries. Let's see. Let's take a look here. But you have a lot of people aligning against the US. And part of this is economic and strategic. You know, these are all three countries that have been sanctioned over oil supply into U.S. markets. When that nuclear option of the financial sanctions were released over the war in Ukraine in recent years, we talked about on this podcast how there would be blowback effects to that, where people would essentially try to build separate systems that cut the U.S. out. You've seen this in many aspects over the last couple of years, where the BRICS has tried to become more reliant on intertrade between themselves. They've also talked about their plan not to essentially launch a new currency out of the BRICS too, partially because of, you know, the U.S. still dominates the financial flows, financial system. So this is a way that they aren't susceptible to funny business. A great example of this in history is our own United States American Revolution, their own currency, which the UK, the Brits got involved with overinflating, causing a lot of issues. And when you get into this currency game, it can be difficult. But when you're doing deals around physical assets, which we've talked about this podcast too, would be a more likely future, is kind of this divergence between technology and physical assets, and how countries would focus on, you know, their specialties, what they have, and how that goes. But you're seeing that here. Let's look at areas. So when the U.S. invaded invaded Syria back in, I believe 2004. You know, this was an Obama administration thing. Hillary Clinton was one of the chief designers of this. Jake Sullivan, who's now currently serving in the Obama administration. But here's a picture from the BBC from 2019 that shows basically the divisions of where we have it right now. The Kurdish-led forces are up here in the northeast, and this is the area that the U.S. essentially helps them militarily control, and the U.S. manages a lot of the production here. A lot of their oil fields, oil dense fields, are up here in the northeast. So the Homs governance is here in the central area, where you have gas fields and then also the ability to transport this, kind of marked on, you know, granted this 2009, but there's a big old river that flows through here that kind of offers a geographic barrier between the Kurdish areas where the U.S. has strong military placements in and are producing the oil. So it's pretty interesting. So you have adversaries down here that are talking about essentially adversaries of the U.S. aligning to reinforce industrial growth here in the Central Pact and essentially do the same thing that the U.S. has been doing up here. It's very interesting. And as you've seen with Russia and Iran bringing together closer relations, it's kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend, so to speak, as the old saying goes. And they're really looking how they can band together against this narrative of, you know, United States, Western countries, Western democratic countries are evil. And I obviously don't think that that's the case, but we have made a lot of tactical mistakes based on ideology over the last 60 years that have put us in this situation. When it comes from a base level, a lot of people are really looking for jobs, economic development, and to use what they have. So here's a quote. In 2009, former U.S. President Donald Trump detailed why Washington intends to uphold the occupation of northeast Syria, saying, "We want to bring our soldiers home, but we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil," you know, typical Trump fashion. But it's a complicated thing because we're in there where we've committed ourselves around the world to a lot of not great strategic decisions. But the problem is basically just withdrawing, kind of like we did with Afghanistan, you know, the cut and run sort of philosophy. There's a lot of issues with it. you know, Afghanistan holds less strategic value to the U.S. besides being a area where major poppies and opium is grown. But it's a difficult situation we found ourselves in. I think maybe they're using our same toolkit here to really understand how things are working on a global integrated manner and how our past decisions are affecting people's strategic decisions today and what they essentially are trying to do for the future. So America has, like Rome did, this massive empire. And when Rome fell, they really integrated that empire into the Roman Catholic Church because they weren't able to govern it globally from a military aspect. The war now, or global military power is becoming more decentralized. And you're seeing that really from our focus on military technology. I believe we talked about the Red Dragon system on here, but more stuff that can be delivered where it needs to be rather than these long-term military applications or occupations. And it's just, you know, U.S. military strategy is more cohesive when you look 5 to 10 years out, despite the chaos. I think there's been a really good understanding, especially as of late, where our place in the world is, where it's not working. And it's really on our ability to build a new world where it's more relevant. But that also, like, you know, sending your kid to college, they're not living at your home anymore. And you have to trust and support those people in a manner that helps to their self-determination. But it's hard to overcome basically clear understandings that people like to be free. They like to express their local culture. They like national identity. And that's a good thing up to the point where it becomes uber nationalist, like you saw with Germany during World War II, and forgetting what the other side wants. Now, oftentimes we've run across the world and left situations like this where we're in Syria, we're committed, but there's, you know, like with this refinery and also China and Russia's more partnership approach with Syria, that it's kind of like, do these people really want to be together, or are we forcing them together because we've cut them out of our system? And I think a lot of people saw what we did and publicly stated as we were trying to destroy countries financially by hitting at their citizens, and how that didn't work out like we expected, that it's brought up a lot of strategic vulnerabilities for the U.S. and foreign policy that didn't necessarily exist there before. So whether or not the U.S. empire is failing, like a lot of people have said, or reshaping, it is in a time that we need to really be critical about what we're doing globally and try to find unique and a different way of doing things, because this is, a lot of people feel the strategy is essentially bankrupt our country. And what we're seeing right now too is, you know, we're in Ukraine and we're basically keeping their government open by paying their citizens to really public servants. Like the U.S. is the primary funder of their government pensions. And it's just another situation that could have been handled better and we're trapped in, and we can't just walk away full stop, but it's not sustainable, you know? So Europe's funding has gone more for military aid, so weapons and stuff. And that makes a lot of sense because it provides Ukraine's always provide a barrier between East and West, and the Dnipro River that cuts right through Kyiv and goes down to the sea there, that cuts right next to Crimea. Crimea is where East and West intersect through the consolidation of the rivers. And then you have Turkey to the south. It's very complicated. And you see that these sides are very fluid. And a lot of people are not happy with the U.S. strategy previously and going forward, and are looking for us to commit to a strategy long-term, binding strategies, but really also be realistic about what the people on the ground want and need and what this multipolar world looks like. Because it seems, at least from my perception, a lot of countries have lost trust in the U.S. as a strategic partner. You know, maybe that's where Europe steps in. If they become more unified as the United States of Europe, if they'll be able to reshape our balance, and really kind of almost have their own revolution where countries come together because they're forced to and make more decisions that are autonomous to their own destiny and future, rather than acting, at least militarily, as a, you know, some, I don't think it's fair, but some people would say a vassal state of the Washington, D.C. But I think it's more, I would say more about having self-reliance on things like military policy, and being a leader in the world. Who do we want to be? How do we protect our borders? You know, the Schengen free travel zone is, I'd say, under attack for the EU. It's been a huge, a huge benefit for your United States travelers for years that I've personally benefited from. But it's Europe's growing, or the EU especially, is growing up. And I think part of the reason that they've been forced to do that is because the lack of leadership at the top in the United States from both parties over the last 10 to 20 something years. So we'll see how this pans out, but I expect to see more of these BRIC style partnerships that may not be like a formulated overall group, but it's countries focused on resources and business making deals. And, you know, I really think that you'll see Saudi Arabia specifically step up as a global leader, and Mohammed bin Salman as a go-between, really, between East and West in recent years, or coming years, that hopefully will keep the peace, but will also benefit from both sides basically having to invest in their future to ensure a adult is in the room at all times, and that the stability in that country provides a stability for the broader world. So it's a, you know, this is the natural outcome from, you know, strategy being built around over the last 20, 30 years, that we will go to war with Iran. We will go to war with Russia. We will go to war with China, because it's inevitable, and what that means. So, you know, let's look at one more thing. So the Thucydides trap is a term popularized by American political scientist Graham T. Allison to describe an apparent tendency towards war when emergency power threatens to displace an existing great power as a regional or international hegemon. This has been something that's been branded around, like right here it says 2015, to talk about the analysis of potential conflict between the United States and the People's Republic of China. And it really focuses around the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, that it was inevitable because the Spartans were afraid of the growth of the Athenian power. Let's see if they have any maps here. No maps. But when you look back at the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, what kicked that off was, okay, here's a decent map, was that these different groups, and it's even more defined in some other books that I've read, but essentially you have what you have now, where Russia's like, you know, you said you wouldn't go this far, you're playing in our sandbox. And when you had here the Spartan Confederacy and the Athenian empires and allies, some of the maps are more defined, but you have all these little pockets around here where people were like, you're getting too close, so to speak. You're getting too involved in our domestic politics, and you're getting too broad. This Peloponnesian War was started as trading, like we have, like we just talked about with Syria, Iran, and stuff like that, trying to become more strategically aligned because it benefited them as people or entities that felt slighted by these larger powers. But we're in it right now. You know, you have all basically clash of the alliances, clash of the titans. And this is the same thing that we're living in now. It's been discussed as at least from 2015, according to Wikipedia here, but I would say much earlier, that we're in this scenario again. And it says China and the US are currently on a collision for course for war. I do agree with that, but it's very difficult to avoid at this point. You know, there's going to have to be the ability, especially for the US, to simmer down now. And, you know, Mark Milley, who's the head of Joint Chief of Staffs, he just resigned. I feel personally that he's been criticized too much. He's very right on a lot about a lot of tactical things that we had to do to change our military. But, you know, he was branded a traitor by Trump recently for taking a call, I think it was after January 6th, from the Chinese the ambassador or something like that, really to check if we were stable as a country. And it's when talking, like we've done with Russia, just coldly cutting off all diplomatic communications. The talks may be hard, and in negotiations, nobody's going to get fully what they want. But to coexist in this world, both on a geopolitical nation state sense, but also in aspects like religion and politics, we need to have frank discussions again about what we want, what we need, and what that means for us as a collective. And we're not going to like what we hear. Other people's aren't going to like what we hear either, but not having that discussion leads you in this trap that it's been something that we've talked about for quite a long time, you know, and it's a weird thing because the U.S. really helped China become a rising power out of the Maoist revolution style terms, like ideology. But it's pretty funny. I think there's a very huge, complicated relationship between the U.S. of the past and the U.S. of now, and the painful feelings globally of these states from the past and how we interpret that now. Eventually, there's going to have to be a honest heart-to-heart where we kind of go through a completion of where we were and how we got here in an honest, frank discussion, which I feel is somewhat happening now, but not at a political level, and try to find a way to stop looking at each other purely as the enemy. But also, you know, peace through strength, you know, really modernizing our military in a decentralized manner, where if stuff hits the fan, we can meet people on the battlefield where it is, not where it previously was, and set up camp there and stake it out forever. That really conflicts global control. But if, you know, United States as the world leader blows up itself, then we're already going to be there already. So more to come, more strategic deals to come, more of the places that have been slighted by the U.S. or other countries to form alliances with us or the slighted countries, especially in areas like the Pacific and East Asia, where certain countries are worried about expanding Chinese power over there and influence in the region. And the U.S. is afraid of basically not having places to land that can be strategic outposts in case of a war, for stuff like refueling, supply chain distribution, and the like. So it's going to be a fun world living through this the next 20 to 30 years. And things are very, very prone to changing, especially in these periods where it's big thing happens overnight. But we've been here before, you know, and other countries have been here before. Britain used to dominate the seas, and they're not the power that they once were, but they are still a global player, really tied together by a monarchy that still has extreme amount of power and influence globally. So, I mean, the best hope that we can do at this point is to stay together, find out what we really want in terms of ideals and strategy, and really go through towards that stuff.
If you would like to learn more about the New Next podcast, find us at thenewnextpodcast.com, where you can suggest a topic you would like for us to cover. If you enjoyed what you heard, share the podcast, tell a friend about it, or rate us with 5 stars.